From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. We've got a couple of interesting topics on our show today. Later on the program, we'll hear about an exhibit that's traveling through our area all about immigrant journeys from south of the border. And it's pretty self-explanatory if you listen to the title. It's about eight different people who have immigrated from south of the U.S. border into Wisconsin and are now part of our communities here in Wisconsin. But right now, we're talking about Salt Awareness Week, which is coming up, and we'll tell you all about it. And what more appropriate time of the year to be thinking about all that salt that we're putting on the ground at this time of year, and what happens to it, and how can we make maybe better, maybe more sustainable choices in that way. Joining us to talk about that issue is Allison Madison. She's with Wisconsin Saltwise. Allison, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ezra. Yeah, really excited to be here today and chat with you and Lewis.
Lewis, who Allison just mentioned, is Lewis Coleman of the City of La Crosse. He's the environmental planner for La Crosse. Lewis, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
And we're talking about Salt Awareness Week. And I'll be honest, until I started reading the literature in preparation for this show, I lived for most of my adult life in a place where they didn't really very often use salt or need to. I lived in the South where you know, there's not a lot of that going on. And so it never occurred to me the detrimental effects that all this salt that we put on the roads and in our water softeners and everywhere else can have. Allison, talk about our growing understanding of the dangers of using salt and why it's such an important thing to think about.
Yeah, thanks, Ezra. And I grew up in northern Wisconsin. Definitely salt went down around walkways and sidewalks. But it's really been in more recent decades that we've begun to rely more and more heavily on the use of salt on our sidewalks, our roads in southern Wisconsin, definitely in water softeners. And all of the salt that we have been putting down is ending up in our freshwater. So it's actually a global problem. We're seeing salt concentrations increase in freshwater lakes and streams, as well as our groundwater, which for most of Wisconsinites is our drinking water as well. So salt definitely degrades freshwater ecosystems. It stresses out the organisms that have evolved to live in freshwater. And it is not beneficial to human health as well, especially if you're supposed to be on a low sodium diet. It can be detrimental. And also, people often overlook that, you know, salt's it's an effective de-icer, but it's pretty corrosive. You know, we see that on our cars. It also prematurely ages bridges and roads. And so the Wisconsin Saltwise message is just to use salt in a smart fashion, right? To be salt wise doesn't mean that we can't use salt, but it means we should think about all of the impacts and just use it as needed and try to rely first on mechanical means of snow and ice removal.
So when you're carrying this message out to people, you're talking to members of the public, you're interacting with municipalities and with all kinds of different people, how often are you finding people to be fairly receptive to this message versus how often are you finding people who just, you know, that's the way we've always done it, leave me alone?
Yeah, there's definitely a whole spectrum there. But what I like to, you know, always remind people is it's not the way we've always done it, right? We didn't put salt down until about like the 1950s, 1960s. Some communities in northern Wisconsin still really don't. People used to be a bit more cautious on roads, you know, snow tires were a thing. So it's definitely not the way we've always done it. We've kind of, I feel like been coddled over the last several decades by municipalities who have switched over to thinking, you know, we need to have bare pavement in the winter instead of making roads that are safe and passable for the conditions. But yeah, I would say that our counties and our municipalities are actually really receptive to the idea of smart salting. They're seeing the impacts of salt use on, you know, their infrastructure. They're also seeing the cost of salt go up quite a bit every year. And so what the state, the DOT is doing, working to educate the counties who maintain our state highways, is getting them to use best practices that can still maintain great road conditions, but with more appropriate use of salt. So we're seeing a movement to really calibrate in our trucks, our salters, the use of liquid brine on roads before the storm, which works as an anti-icing. It's kind of like putting oil on your skillet before you cook. You always do that, right? The food sticks and you're scraping it up afterwards. So by using a little liquid brine before the storm, it's a pre-treatment that can minimize the need for rock salt afterwards. And yeah, we're seeing movement towards, you know, better plow blades, kind of how those blades are used, going out and plowing more even at lower snowfall depths, instead of, you know, waiting for 2 inches of snow and then plowing. You know, if people can get out there and plow rather than relying on salt, we see some really big savings. So municipalities across the state are reducing their salt use by 50%, 50%, and sometimes even more by adopting these best practices. So like I said, a lot of great work being done by the state, the counties, the municipalities. And I think the next kind of audiences we're trying to work with are those, you know, private contractors, school districts, anybody who's maintaining their own parking lots and sidewalks, where we sometimes see that really egregious oversalting, where you're crunching on salt under your boots, you know, and it's dry pavement underneath that salt. And that's kind of the next audience we really want to be working with in the coming year.
Lewis Coleman, the City of La Crosse environmental planner. Tell me about La Crosse's approach right now, where we can talk about, you know, the past or how things have changed or whatever, but what's the current approach from the City of La Crosse to salt use?
Sure. We've had a salt brine truck for a few years, and the practice with that has been to make sure that's applied at hilly sections of the city, and also like sharp curves. So we're making sure that the sort of the most dangerous parts of the city are pre-treated. The streets department is in the process of getting two more brine trucks. So we're gonna also start applying brine to intersections before storms. So that's kind of where the city's going, and, you know, following the best practices that Allison had mentioned as well.
So when people see the you know, what we've always called the salt truck driving down the road and spreading, is that a straight salt mixture? I see it looks a lot more like dirt than it did when I was a kid. Has that mixture changed over the years?
That's a good question. Yeah, I'm not sure. Allison might be able to add a little bit more about the freezing temperature of salt and how applicable that is versus sand. But I know, like, the sand that we give to our community members when people are looking to, you know, get more traction, that has a little bit of salt in it just to make sure the sand doesn't clump up and freeze. So typically there is a mixture, but I think it's more because of the freezing temperature and below a certain point, salt isn't gonna do anything. We just need to work on getting traction. So that's where the sand comes in.
Okay, so in that sense, the sand is actually more helpful, and somebody throwing pounds and pounds of salt on their, you know, when it's 20 below zero and they're trying to get rid of ice, that's just not going to do anything.
Exactly.
Correct. Yeah. And the temperature is actually 15 degrees Fahrenheit. So if it's below 15
degrees,
which,
okay,
right, for a bit this winter, then that's when you want to switch to sand or something else for traction.
I remember when I was a kid, I had a friend who lived not in the country, but in a slightly more rural part of town, and they heated their home with wood, and then during the winter, His dad would take the ashes from the wood that they heat their house with, and they had this huge, huge driveway that curved up this massive hill, and they didn't use any salt on the hill. He just used those ashes all winter long, again, saying that it would help with traction. And when I was learning to drive, I slid all the way off that hill, but my friend and his family seemed to navigate it just fine. So I guess that might have helped. Is that something, if people don't have sand, can they just take like ashes from the fireplace? And have you heard of people doing that?
I've heard of a number of things. Yeah. I mean, ashes, I'd say I don't hear about that too often. I don't think there's all that many folks with wood fireplaces these days, but I've also heard about birdseed. So if you are a bird lover, you might put some birdseed, I mean, on your sidewalk. I don't know if you really want to, you know, encourage the birds to go out in the road, but yeah, various things to just kind of deal with this, the ice, right? If it's super cold. I mean, I also have invested in a pair of, I think one brand is Yak Tracks, you know, like little spikes to put on my boots when I'm going out. But yeah, there are a variety of things beyond just the chemical means of salt and de-icers. And you had mentioned, Ezra, that, you know, you're seeing these labels where people will say, oh, this is pet friendly or environmentally friendly. And unfortunately, there's no truth in labeling around de-icers. So yeah, so the bags might say that, and that doesn't mean that there's anything in there beyond just straight salt, sodium chloride. Sometimes they might have magnesium chloride or calcium chloride, which have slightly lower melting points than sodium chloride. So it can help at lower temperatures. Those are the bags that probably tend to be a little more expensive, but they still have that word chloride in them, right? So they're still salts, and they still have those negative impacts on our sidewalks and on our water.
So another thing that I see in packaging, in marketing, rather than something being called salt, it'll be called ice melt. Is that just a salt product in another label?
Yeah, the vast majority of our de-icers are salts. So I have a chemistry background. So I mean, a salt can mean a lot of things, but yeah, sodium chloride, magnesium chloride, sometimes potassium chloride are the main ingredients we're going to have in our de-icers. Sodium chloride is the cheapest. Rock salt is the cheapest. And then sometimes there could be some acetates in there as well, but there is no environmentally friendly de-icer. So nothing is truly pet friendly or environmentally friendly unless you don't use it.
You're using the shovel and the ice scraper and maybe, as we talked about, a little bit of sand or something like that, that's not corrosive.
Correct. Yeah. And people can make a difference with what you're doing around your home, because one teaspoon of salt pollutes 5 gallons of water. So if you can even, you know, keep one teaspoon of salt going down, you're protecting 5 gallons of water. And, you know, if you don't do that on the front end, if you see that there is extra salt down on your steps or your sidewalk, you can get out, you know, after the storm and sweep that up and reuse it. So that's another message we want to get out to folks.
That's interesting. And I'm glad you brought up the pollution impact there, because that's what we want to talk about coming up next. Well, this is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm joined by Allison Madison of Wisconsin Saltwise and Lewis Coleman of the city of La Crosse. And we're talking about Salt Awareness Week, which is, Allison, I'm going to ask you for the dates. It's next week, isn't it?
Yes, January 24th to the 28th.
Yes, so we're raising awareness for the ways that we use salt and the ways that we maybe should think of a different way forward. And we'll continue that conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to find a previous episode of this show, or if you'd like to listen to part of our conversation that you might have missed, it's available online at our website. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. WPR.org/newsmakers. Our program continues in a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse, And we're joined today by Lewis Coleman of the City of La Crosse and Allison Madison from Wisconsin Saltwise. Allison, we've been talking about salt. We've been talking about its corrosive impact on our vehicles, on city infrastructure, and why people want to use a different product. But you talked about just the lasting effect in our environment, and I was impressed by this statistic that you quoted, and which is also on your website, about the environmental impact of just a small amount of salt. I want you to say that again, because it hits me in such a way that I can almost not even process it.
The statistic is that 1 teaspoon of salt permanently pollutes 5 gallons of water.
That's amazing.
And it is amazing. It's amazing, and it's pretty scary when we see the amount of salt that goes down every year. We're literally polluting hundreds of billions of gallons of water in our state. But I mentioned that there is a lot of reason for hope. We're seeing municipalities in the state really cut their salt use, sometimes by upwards of 50%. And what we need now are for private contractors, for public citizens, for everybody who does winter maintenance to be adopting these best practices so that we can protect our water resources in Wisconsin. So, you know, just like we can't pull salt out of the ocean water, we can't pull salt out of water once it's there. So what we can do is work to prevent it from getting into our water in the first place. The Wisconsin DNR has identified over 40 water bodies in Wisconsin that are currently impaired. They've been degraded due to high salt or high chloride concentrations. So they're keeping an eye on a number of sites across the state. All of the long-term monitoring stations that the DNR is looking at in Wisconsin, they're all showing increased concentrations of salt. And we're seeing that in these lakes and streams, and we're also seeing it in our drinking water. So it definitely is time for people across the state to become aware of this issue and to start making some changes.
Lewis, in terms of the city of La Crosse, as you look at environmental aspects of how the city goes about its work, how receptive are some of your colleagues in other departments who are responsible for getting their job done, and they just want to find the most efficient way? I don't mean to diminish that, but they want to find the most efficient and effective way to do their job, and here you come around the corner and are like, hey, but what about the environment? And what's the reaction there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, when we talk about water too, you know, we have a wastewater treatment plant, and they're dealing with the same issues of, you know, what do we do with all this chloride in the water? So that's a really good indicator and a really good support for the advocacy work that we're doing. I think from, you know, helping some of our, say, our groundskeeping staff and our streets department, if we're thinking about it in terms of efficiency, we're also thinking about it in terms of cost. So the way, if we can reduce costs, I think that's one really good way to convince people to change their behavior. And also just like just the time and maintenance it takes. I think we're seeing that this is having an impact on not just our winter maintenance, but also our summer maintenance. Like when you see sidewalks that have been heavily salted, you've got dead grass and sometimes barren dirt on either side of those sidewalks. And they're just in the winter, sometimes they're just white, not from snow, but from salt. And also the corrosion. So like, I mean, the more salt and salt water is corroding that, the more frequently you have to replace it. So if you can take a sort of long view and a broad scope of the environmental impact, I think that helps with, you know, making those considerations day to day. And Saltwise has some good tools about that as well. They've got the these cups where you can say, like, if you fill this cup with, you know, so much salt, that'll be just enough for taking care of like five or six sidewalk squares. So I think tools like that really help people visualize it and makes it easier and for people to do the best job they can.
In terms of some of the numbers that Allison was talking about, she talked about some municipalities cutting their salt use by as much as 50%. Does the city of La Crosse have a goal like that in place, or has any of that been measured in terms of La Crosse's salt use?
That's a good question. Not that I'm aware of, but I know it's on the radar. Allison came up to La Crosse and Onalaska area to workshop with a number of transportation departments. So I think there's a lot of good energy in the region around this. So sharing best practices amongst different departments, I think, is really going to help. But I'll be working with the streets department to get a good grip on that. It's kind of difficult to figure out how to measure it. I think we're getting more and more precise measurements of the salt we're using through computerization. So I think that'll help. I mean, but you know, before that, it'd probably just be like, well, how much did you spend on salt this year? Well, how much are you spending the year before? So I think it's more like the cost and weight overall. But if we're going to get, I think with the advanced technology, we can be more precise with not only the application, but also with the measurement. So that'll help.
You talked about, I don't know that this is available, how many cities locally this is available in. We have a lot of different little cities, townships, et cetera, in our listening area. But as far as La Crosse itself, there are ways for the public to get that sand mixture from you. I know we've got a couple of buckets of it in my garage at home. Tell people where and how that's available.
This is a guess, but
We
we'll
love
have to
guessing
va
on the radio. Go
we'll
ahead.
have to val we'll have to validate later. But most likely there's salt and sand mixtures available on our at our municipal service center on Isle of Plume. So that'd probably be the best bet for any de-icing, because that's where our street trucks are using it and getting it. So that's probably the best source.
Is that is my memory correct? Is that where people like take their yard waste in the summer and that sort of thing? Same place. Okay, good deal. And you can just if you find out that that's not the case, let me know and we'll get on a future episode and let people know where they can in fact locate that.
Good. Yeah, I'll follow up.
Allison, as far as steps that individual people can take, we've been talking a lot about municipalities and private organizations and, you know, blacktop parking lots that are somehow white during the winter. But what can individual people do to have the most impact on this issue?
Well, I have to first put in a plug that they can educate themselves and encourage others to learn more. This coming week, January 24th through the 28th, is Wisconsin Salt Awareness Week, and we're hosting daily webinars from 12:30 noon, noon 30 to 1, and folks can hear from experts, freshwater ecologists to water softening professionals to geologists, like all speak about just really all aspects of this issue. So I would say people can work to learn more on Wisconsin Saltwise website, Wisconsin Salt Awareness Week this coming week. A few other things that we tell people all the time is our three S's: shovel, scatter, switch. And you want to remember it in that order. So number one, shovel, like get out there. If there is any precipitation, and shovel the snow up as soon as possible. If you can get out there sooner before people, you know, walk over it and it bonds to the pavement, you're going to be in a much better situation. And sometimes the sun will come and help you with the rest of it. So shovel. Then if you do need to use salt, scatter. So really think about, you know, having some space between salt grains. It's actually about 3 inches between salt grains is enough to take care of, you know, a small amount of ice, a small coating of ice. You know, not if you have a glacier in your backyard, it's not going to work, but that should be good. And like Lewis mentioned earlier, we have some cups. So a 10 ounce cup is enough for actually 10 sidewalk squares. Wow. So we tend to just really overfly. Yeah.
So basically, so shovel, one ounce of salt per sidewalk square, if I'm breaking the math down right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wow.
And yeah.
I got to write so, that down. Changing practice immediately.
Well, I'll get a cup your way next time I'm in town.
Perfect.
So, yeah. So shovel, scatter, and then switch. Like we mentioned earlier, when it gets really cold, you want to switch from salt and de-icers to sand or something for traction. So switching your products at about 15 degrees. So shovel, scatter, switch, the three big S's. And then I would add that fourth one I mentioned, to sweep. So if you do see a lot of extra salt down afterwards, sweep that up, reuse it for the next storm rather than letting it, you know, blow away or just kind of get kicked off the sidewalk, because all of that salt is headed to our freshwater. And I did have a group of Boy Scouts last year went with their whole troop, and they just kind of went down the block and swept up a whole bunch of extra salt that they, you know, saw around. So if you, you know, have some motivated young kids in your household or in your neighborhood, you know, maybe you can get them out during Salt Awareness Week this next week.
That sounds great. Allison Madison with Wisconsin Saltwise has been one of our guests today on Newsmakers. Allison, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ezra.
Lewis Coleman is the environmental planner with the City of La Crosse. Lewis, thank you as well for joining us on Newsmakers today. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, I'd love to hear from you. Our email address is newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. Coming up, a conversation about immigrant journeys from south of the border to right here in Wisconsin, and that's next, right here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Thank you so much for joining us for a really interesting conversation today. We're talking about an exhibit that's making its way through our listening area called Immigrant Journeys from South of the Border. It features people who are from Colombia, Mexico, Honduras, Uruguay, and now live in Wisconsin. And we're here with Bill Berry, who's a journalist and an author and speaker, and has collected a lot of these people's wonderful stories, and Dina Wartzel, who's the executive director of Wisconsin Humanities. First of all, Dina, Bill, welcome to Newsmakers. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you, Ezra.
So we're talking about immigrant journeys from the south, immigrant journeys from south of the border, and I don't know a bit of Spanish, but there's a Spanish part of the exhibit's name, which I'm going to attempt. Immigrant journeys from south of the border, Mi Travesía Hasta Wisconsin. Did I get it even close, Dina?
You did great. I'm not a Spanish speaker either, but I'm trying.
Good deal. I hope you know enough to tell me what that means.
It means my journey to Wisconsin.
My journey to Wisconsin, as we get a little bit of digital latency there. Boy, living in 2022, that's how it goes. So the exhibit features the stories of eight immigrants to Wisconsin from many of the locations that I mentioned in the introduction. And it features their stories, their photos, and is traveling really all over the state and has been for a year or so now, but is now in our listening area. We'll tell people where they can see that a little bit later. But let's talk about how the project got started. Dina, how did this idea first get conceived?
Well, so my organization, Wisconsin Humanities, our job is to deepen Wisconsinites' participation in civic life and our understanding of one another through humanities-based educational and cultural programs, things like this exhibit. So several years ago, when we saw that the national conversation around immigration was deepening some divisions and causing, you know, really some upset in our communities, we felt strongly as an organization that we had to do something to improve understanding of immigration and of the people who have come to this state. So at that point for us, the path was obvious. We did what we always do, which is look for people who have the knowledge and the deep community connections that we believe are necessary to engaging the public in conversations that are respectful and authentic. So while I'd actually never worked with the folks at Centro Hispano in Madison, where our office is located, I reached out to them. And they're a wonderful organization there that serves Spanish-speaking people, both immigrants and native-born people. I reached out and I said, hey, are you guys, you know, thinking about immigration? Is this something that we can help you with? And they were thrilled.
So how were the subjects chosen, the eight people who are ultimately featured in the exhibit?
Those people were selected by our friends at Centro Hispano. They reached out to their large community and, you know, invited people to come forward. We certainly, I mean, when we started thinking about the exhibit from the very start, I reached out to Bill and his wonderful colleague, Gary Porter, who took the photos, and together we formed a team with Karen Menendez-Culler, the amazing executive director of Centro. And so we all put our heads together to think of, you know, what kinds of people we would like to invite. And certainly we were hoping to, you know, show something of the diversity, the breadth of, you know, people who come to Wisconsin from other countries, not just the nations of origin, but the kinds of things they do. And I know Bill's going to, you know, like to speak more about, you know, some of the wonderful people in the exhibit, but they really, you know, do all kinds of things, and they come from all kinds of backgrounds, and they bring so many different things to Wisconsin.
That's Dina Wartzel, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Humanities. Bill Berry is with us as well. He's a journalist and author, and really is the one responsible for collecting the stories of the eight people who are featured. And Bill, I'm wondering about people who have been so much to come to this country, and the stresses that they have been under, and the different kinds of pressure that they can experience. Was there any difficulty getting these subjects to open up to you? I know that can be one of the challenges of being a journalist, is getting, finding the person who's actually willing to talk.
Well, you hit it right on the head, Ezra. That was a hurdle, and especially is a hurdle among a population that is under stress and duress. Many of the people that we talk to, they have varying immigration status, and their family members have different immigration status. So in many cases, some of the people that we talk to who are naturalized citizens were still fearful to talk to us because they had family members who were not. So it was really an effort to gain confidence among people, and I have to give credit to Karen Menendez-Culler for being there with us, helping to calm some people's nerves at times and do some translation. And I've worked with Gary Porter a number of times over the years. He was a longtime photographer with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he has such an easy way about it that really puts people in a place of comfort. So it was difficult, but, you know, we sort of approached it with some goals to work with these people in an honest and sincere manner, and compassionate, and also very clear with them about what our goals were. And they were wonderful.
Talk about the challenge of communicating with someone where language differences are an issue in that communication. You talked about some of the folks needing some help with translation. I can hear from some audio that we have available to us that some of them speak very good English and others less so. So how was that? How did you overcome that challenge?
Well, I know just enough Spanish to be dangerous, and so I needed help there. And once again, Karen Menendez-Culler was at our side, and in a couple situations, I served as a translator. So there were really we were really working in concert with Karen, and so we spent an awful lot of time with each of the people, and then we had to really boil that down into a digestible amount of information. So her help was invaluable, especially in the translation part. And so it was a challenge, but you know, that's what journalism is about, right, Ezra? And we were more than happy to do it. It was one of the most rewarding projects I've ever worked on.
I mentioned that there's some audio of some of these people. I'm gonna get you to tell us a little bit about at least a few of these subjects. One of them, the very first one you see on the website is a young lady named Anna Claudia, and she works in the financial industry. And in the audio that you can hear on the website, which is WisconsinImmigrantJourneys.org, Anna Claudia talks about wanting to use the skills that she's learning in the financial industry to help other immigrant families as well. Let's listen.
I want to do a project to teach Latino people how to save money and educate them about it. And my manager support me. She's great.
Tell me about Anna Claudia, Bill. What was she like to meet?
Well, she was a very strong person, and was not the least bit intimidated by our presence, and made it very clear at times. For instance, when I mispronounced a name or a word, she was very quick to correct it. And you know, I think that came from her own real need to come here from Uruguay in a very difficult situation. And I think what she did was developed a strong sense of who she was and what her goals were. And so she was a very interesting person to talk to. No nonsense whatsoever. As she said, her goals are clearly to help others in her community with the day-to-day business of managing your personal finances. And fortunately, she works in a credit union setting where the folks have been very supportive. And so I think she's well on her way to achieving those goals. A very, very serious-minded person.
There's a young man in the exhibit named Gilberto. I enjoyed reading his story because he's in college, wants to study medicine, is working his way through that, but he works a lot in addition to being in college, which you don't always see students do these days, and he kind of laughed a little bit, made light of what happens when people ask him, why are you working so much?
A lot of people tell me, like, why are you doing that many jobs? And I'm like, well, why do you think I can't afford tuition on my own? And my parents can't afford to pay it for me, so I have to take the initiative and gather that money on my own while studying at the same time.
He's what we call a dreamer. He's one of the younger people who is in school and has been here since childhood. And tell me a little bit more about Gilberto.
Well, you know, what a fantastic interview that was, and what an amazing person. His whole family, obviously. Gilberto came from Mexico. His mother and father moved here from difficult circumstances there for the safety of their family. Father was a doctor in Mexico, and last I knew, he was working in maintenance at UW Madison. Now, Gilberto, you said he was a dreamer. You're correct, and he was a student at the time of the interview. And the reason that he said he had to work three jobs there is because dreamers are not eligible for the kinds of financial assistance that other students are. So, I mean, literally, he paid his way through college penny by penny. And we had the chance, Dean and I, to have a little exchange with Karen just yesterday. And we were thrilled to, as you mentioned, his goal was to become a doctor, a medical doctor. And his goal beyond that was to work in the area of public health to serve people like those in his community. We were just thrilled to learn just last night that he's now full-time medical student at UC Irvine on a full ride that he earned all his own. And so what a reminder that, and this is the case with many of the people we talked to, they're helped by folks like Centro Hispano to develop a plan for how they can succeed and then to work with determination to achieve that plan. And so he's just a great example of exactly that. Have a plan, put your pieces together that you need to, and get to work.
That is really amazing. And and to see his success and the effort that he put into it. And Dina, I'm looking at all the different stories that are part of this traveling exhibit, Immigrant Journeys from South of the Border. And I'm thinking about why this work is so important, because a lot of things that you see in terms of portrayals, there are stories even this week about the way television shows portray people from minority backgrounds or immigrant backgrounds and those kinds of things. And yet you see this young man who is in this country and now is able to do something really amazing based all, you know, solely on his own effort and his own determination to just do it. How important is it for an organization like yours to feature stories like this for exactly that reason, to sort of counter some of the negative stereotypes that people see?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, for Wisconsin to thrive, for our communities to thrive, we have to come together. We have to work together. And, you know, we believe as an organization that the best way we can do that is by understanding one another and meeting each other where we are. And it takes all of us. So, you know, it is, you know, we all walk around with stereotypes about others in our heads. That's just how humans work. That's how the brain works. You know, that's not, you know, that's not pointing fingers. That's just saying that's how we work. But, you know, so the opportunity then is to say, okay, if that's the way our minds work, then if we know we need to come together and that, you know, we're all richer together if we embrace the cultural landscape that is Wisconsin, you know, then the, one of the best ways to do it is through stories of real people. And, you know, what I love about this exhibit is that, you know, the story that you just told about Gilberto is an incredibly uplifting story. But, you know, these are also human beings. They're like, you know, they're like you, me, Bill, you know, they have their struggles, they have their flaws, some of the stories, you know, some of the people talk about, you know, in their own life experience, their own changing thoughts about who they are and how they need to be in the world. So it's also just really about our humanity and seeing past the labels so that we can just meet each other as humans and work together.
Bill, speaking of those stories, we certainly don't have time to go through all of them, but what's another one of the stories you want to make sure that people hear about during our conversation today?
Well, all of them, in short, but, you know, a couple stand out for me. One was an interview with a young man named Saul. It's spelled S-A-U-L, but pronounced Saul. And he, at the time, was an apprentice carpenter with J.P. Cullen, a Janesville-based construction firm. And we were able to get to him because one of Dina's board members had a connection with the Central Labor Council in Madison. And so we got to Saul, and, you know, he had a very compelling story of crossing the border and nearly dying. He was dehydrated and near death when he reached Arizona, and if not for the help of a good soul who greeted he and his mother there, he might not have had a chance to be an apprentice carpenter at J.P. Cullen. He came to Madison, and like some of the other men that we interviewed in this series, he encountered more overt, direct kinds of harassment or anger from others, intimidation. But he always said, you know, his older brother was also there, and he said, you know, you just have to let it pass, and you have to be bigger in some cases than people and let these things pass. And so he was just a great interview because of his determination to he was highly respectful of J.P. Cullen, the company that he was apprenticed at, and his goal was to become a project manager so that he could serve as a model for others from his community. And he wasn't the only male who expressed some concerns about some of the racism they encountered, or some of the anger from others who didn't understand who they were, but his was a very compelling story.
They talked about experiencing anger from people. Is that because of assumptions people made about their immigrant status?
Well, you know, a number of things. You know, they were different in some ways. They maybe had struggles with the language for a while. You know, young students in school can be cruel sometimes to others, and so a variety of reasons that you know again remind me that you know with all these numbers about immigration in Wisconsin, 7% of the state population comes from a Latino or Hispanic background, 300 and some thousand immigrants in the state. We can go on and on with these numbers, but as Dina said so well, these are all human beings, every one of them. And that was our goal, as she said, with this story, was to put a human face on this compelling issue that was reverberating across the country.
Dina, you were talking about the personal stories here and how important it is to tell those personal stories. And I know that this is not the only way in which Wisconsin Humanities gets involved in telling those personal stories. What else is your organization in the midst of that our audience might be interested in learning about?
Well, I would certainly encourage anyone who hasn't yet discovered Love Wisconsin, either on the Love Wisconsin website, which is just lovewy.com, or if you're a Facebook user, you can go on Facebook and we have new stories of first person stories of people from all across the state. Many, many, many from your listening area, Ezra, just people of all ages and backgrounds, and telling their own life stories. And so it's just a wonderful place where we've seen a real community grow of people who support each other, who express gratitude and admiration, and find in the personal stories their commonalities. Often commenting that I never knew that someone, for example, from Honduras might have had the same experience that I had, growing up, in Alma. So it's a beautiful place, and I encourage people to go and read the stories, whether it's on the website or on Facebook. You can join right in the conversation and be part of that great, really wonderful community.
That sounds really interesting, and that's called Love Wisconsin.
Yes.
As far as this exhibit, Immigrant Journeys from South of the Border, Mi Travesía Hasta Wisconsin, it's all over. But let me just highlight two of the exhibits that are going on right now in different parts of our listening area in southwestern Wisconsin. At Viterbo University, it's at the Fine Arts Center at Viterbo through January 26th, and at the Brewer Public Library in Richland Center. Until January 28th. So both of those locations, again, the Brewer Public Library in Richland Center till January 28th, and Viterbo University Fine Arts Center through January 26th. And if you want to see where else the exhibit is going to be traveling through Wisconsin, Dina, where can people find that information?
If you go to the project website, which, as you said, Ezra, is wisconsinimmigrantjourneys.org, there's a list of all of the sites. And also, if you aren't able to get to the exhibit, or maybe you're, not out and about yet because of COVID, all of the stories are available on the website. And even if you do get to the exhibit, which we hope you will, the website also has some other really helpful information. We put together a timeline of the history of immigration to Wisconsin. And many of you who might be of Norwegian extraction or German extraction, Wisconsin is very much a state formed by immigrants, and also immigration of people who are tribal members from other parts of the country. So that whole sweep of human immigration to Wisconsin, we try to share in a fun way on the project website as well.
So the two exhibits are kind of running concurrently in different parts of our listening area. How many of these traveling exhibits do you have going at one time?
We were lucky because a wonderful donor saw the exhibit when we first were taking it around Madison, and was so impressed that she asked what would keep us from bringing it everywhere in Wisconsin. And we said, well, we have more demand than we can possibly meet. So she gave us funds to make a second copy. So we have two copies of this exhibit, and this is the one exhibit we have traveling right now.
That's great. That's wonderful. Dina Wartzel is the Executive Director of Wisconsin Humanities. Dina, thanks a lot for joining us today on Newsmakers.
Oh, thank you so much.
And Bill Berry is a journalist and author and is responsible for collecting the stories that that you've heard about today and the others that we didn't have time to share. Bill, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you, Ezra.
Of course, you can see the exhibit at WisconsinImmigrantJourneys.org, or you can go see it in person at Viterbo University Fine Arts Center through January 26th and at the Brewer Public Library in Richland Center until January 28th. Let me tell you about a couple of opportunities to hear our show every week. We originate Friday mornings at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3, and then we repeat Friday evenings at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9. Of course, you can get in touch with us 24/7, as they say, newsmakers@wpr.org is our email address. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. For producer Dawn Jewell, I'm Ezra Wall. Please join us again next time for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.